So I'd like to offer a disclaimer first. I'm not a public speaker by profession. I'm a mailman, but I'll do my best. Once when I was in Bangkok a few years ago, when Venerable Father was being reprinted, there was a freelance journalist who had written an article or a review of it for a new magazine, and I just happened to be stopping in Bangkok on my way home, and they tried to interview me over the phone, and it didn't go very well. I don't think the article ever got printed, but I think the first question they asked me was, you know, this almost sounds like some sort of cult. And not being a public speaker by profession, I didn't have a very good answer for him, but I thought about that over the years, and I thought it might, it could seem like that to some people who come here and see all the devotees of Ajahn Chah. And so talking about his history, there was no official biography of the great leader, and there was no little red book of his sayings that we learned. And I think one of the central points is that living with him wasn't easy much of the time, and sometimes he intentionally made it not easy, and he could, like Ajahn Sumedho was talking about, he could push you to where you actually felt a great deal of anger towards him. And sometimes he would just send you away. We talk about training with Ajahn Chah, but actually he had many branch monasteries, and often you'd be sent to one of these monasteries for a year, and you might only see him once or twice during that time, but you were still his disciple and training with him. So I see his years of practice and his years of teaching as something continuous. I think the years in which he took up his ascetic practice were something of a golden age in Thailand. There were so many masters at that time, and disciples of Ajahn Mun mostly. And I've just picked up a little bit from things I heard him say and teachings I've read and what other people said. And Ajahn Mun was probably the most influential teacher of the last century. And most of the great masters of the Northeast were his disciples and lived with him for years, and Ajahn Chah was always spoken of as a disciple of Ajahn Mun. And it turned out he only spent 7 days with him. And sometimes just little off-the-cuff remarks that he made, the things that made the strongest impressions and would stay with you. And once he was talking with some monks, and he said, people ask you, how do you call yourself a disciple of Ajahn Mun when you only spent 7 days with him? And he said, if a person with good eyes comes close to something, he sees it. And if a person's eyes aren't good, it doesn't matter how long he stays. So I think there was a strong independent streak in his practice. He had a few teachers that he spoke of as his teachers, and I think he spent a lot of time on his own and learning to rely on himself, and also he often spoke of how he wanted to part ways with those who were half-hearted and lackadaisical about the practice and not fully committed as he was. And as Achan Amaro read, he decided to give it his all. And these are elements that carried over into his teaching and the way he trained people and trained people to rely on themselves, and the way he expected you to not just give it your best shot, but often he put you in situations where you felt he was asking more than you could do. But as Ajahn Sumedho was saying, often all you really had to do was just sit there, which anybody can do when you're not allowed to get up and leave. So, and he talked at different times about experiences he had in meditation, and always willing to challenge himself. And if he was afraid of ghosts, well, he would go and sleep in a charnel ground and wait for something terrifying to happen, and he would see it through. And I think in one teaching he talked about when he went to urinate the next morning, he passed blood in his urine after this terrifying experience in the charnel ground. But he would never flinch from his practice, always going straight ahead. Or he talked about just sitting in the rain under his mosquito net and getting soaked. And you know, in this life, there's, you know, you don't have another set of clothes, and you don't have somewhere to go inside that change into your dry clothes and warm up. You just you're stuck there in your wet clothes through the night, and for however many days it takes for the sun to come out and dry you out. And he's sitting there and crying, thinking, here I am by myself. Nobody even knows I'm here. And the people in the villages are warm and comfortable inside their houses. And I'm this miserable monk. But nothing would deter him. And another experience that he talked about, which is very indicative of the way he practiced and taught, was when he was living alone and had some very powerful experience and strange things happening to his body, or feeling his, I don't remember the details, maybe feeling his body exploding or disappearing or something. And he would ask himself, what was that? And the answer that came to him was, it was what it was. And that was enough for him. And that was pretty much the way he taught people. So in his monasteries, you had the framework of the discipline, and you had his example, and you had usually had plenty of teaching, often more than you wanted to hear. But there weren't scheduled interviews to discuss your practice or your state of mind, although it might happen at times when you were walking with him on alms round, or you just happened to be sitting there quietly with him alone, and he might ask you something and talk in a way he'd never spoken to you before. But generally, he expected you to rely on yourself in this way. And I think this grew out of his own practice. And as I said, he expected you to really give it your all. I think this is where a lot of the best stories came from, the way he trained people. So as I said, he would often send you out to the branch monasteries, and usually the teachers there were they were capable, but they were not Ajahn Chah. sometimes they could be inspiring and sometimes they seem quite ordinary, but you were still under Ajahn Chah's protection and you were just expected to respect the teacher according to the discipline and follow the practice like everybody else. So one of the teachers that I ended up with was one of the senior disciples called Ajahn Sinowen. And he was quite a character in his own right. And he, when Ajahn Amaro was reading about when Ajahn Chah fell in love, I thought about Ajahn Sinowen telling me when he, I guess he was a layperson in his village, and he's, or was he a village monk? I don't remember. And Ajahn Chah and his ascetic monks came walking through, and he'd never seen such restrained, noble-looking people. And even the color of robes of the forest monks are different than the bright robes of the city and village monks. So he found out where they came from and went to see him. And, we generally had this experience of Ajahn Chah as a kindly old man, like a father or a grandfather figure. And you hear some of the older people talk, he was really quite gruff. And Sinowen entered the monastery, and it wasn't the kind of welcome that we would get, but, well, what do you want? And he said, I saw you and your monks, and I was very inspired. I'd like to come and join you and ordain. He said, now, why would you want to do that? I mean, monks are do-nothings, just lazy people. And Sinowen said, yeah, no, I don't think so. We walk in here, the grounds are swept very neatly, and Ajahn Chah said, it sweeps itself. So, Sinowen decided to stay, and he said the first night he got ordained, and then he went to the meditation. And I have this image of him, you know, this spiffy new monk in his new robes. And I mean, for us, it's a very austere way of life, but from somebody from one of those villages, it's actually something to have these nice new robes and position of respect. And you go into the splendid or comparatively splendid temple and they do the chanting and the reflection on the parts of the body. And he started thinking about the girl he'd been in love with in this village. Does she have all those things inside of her? And this described his heart sinking. You know, what am I getting myself into? And he's puzzling over that. And then the chanting ended, and then nothing happened. Everybody just sat there, looking around. Well, what do I do now? So, anyhow, he stayed, and it was always said that Ajahn Chah particularly had it in for Sinowen, because Sinowen was somebody who tended to be lazy and fun-loving, and Sinowen used to say, I don't know what he wants from me. People say, Lumpur says, if Sinowen's suffering, I'm happy. So he described once they were doing some work and he had to hold up a board or something while somebody was nailing it in, and there was a swarm of bees around, and they were, or wasps, and they were flying around and stinging him, and he's holding it up and he feels like his arms are going to fall off, and he said, Lumpur, I don't think I can. And Ajahn Chah whacked him with a stick, and he was just shattered by this, and he went back to his kuti. He thought, this is too much. This is inhumane. And then that night, after the the sitting, Ajahn Chah gave a talk, and he said, I want you to all think about why you're here. This is not something ordinary we're doing. You're all here for escaping from the round of birth and death, and you've been in the grip of your habits, and which they speak of as Mara, the evil one, ever since the moment you were born and for innumerable past lives. So don't think it's going to be easy, but nothing I do is for any other reason than this. And this was one of those stories that always stayed with me. And then many years later, when I was staying with Ajahn Sinowan, we went to Wat Bapong for the Maga Puja gathering, and there was some there was a construction project out by the main gate, and Ajahn Chah was out there overseeing, and we arrived, and there was this huge hole in the ground, and Ajahn Chah saw Sinowan, and he said, "Sinowan, fill up that hole." So we just arrived from the trip, walking down the road, and Sinowan took off his outer robe, got a shovel, and I looked at, well, took off my robe, and we just started filling the hole. And that's just the way it was. Whatever plans you had, you thought you were going to pay your respects, get shown to a kuti, have a bath, take a rest, drink some tea, go to the chanting. But you were filling up a hole until it got dark. And when it gets dark, there are millions of mosquitoes that come out, and they're biting your legs while you're shoveling. It's often been said that Ajahn Chah might sound sadistic. I thought of him as the world's most compassionate sadist. Somebody who read, am I running out of time? Somebody who read Venerable Father when it was in, before it had been published, said to me, and he knew nothing about Ajahn Chah, he said, does come across as a sadist. He said, the way people's minds work is, if you say Joe was a son of a bitch, he said, yeah, probably. But if you say Joe was a saint, he said, well, prove it. So, one of his great gifts, as Ajahn Sumedho said, is that just in an instant, he could put you in a space where you just let go of everything, whatever your anger or your worry, your anxiety, the things that you thought you had to do a lot of work to get through and get rid of, and they would just vanish in front of your eyes, and you find yourself laughing. And where did this great edifice of suffering that you built up go to? And I think we've all met teachers where you listen to them teaching, and just to hear their teaching puts you in a state of meditation. But then there are also a few teachers like Ajahn Chah and some others I've met that just to meet them can put you in a state of meditation. And I think everybody here has had that experience with him. And he taught different people differently. And when Gil told me about this conference, I thought we would probably all have something very different to say, because he gave us what we needed. And some people were very mature or when they went to him, and he taught them on that level. And I was a basket case, and probably nobody else would have accepted me. And he nurtured me along where I could stand on my feet. And it took a great deal of patience and skill, especially when you've got a couple of hundred other monk disciples and a few hundred nuns to take care of. But he always had the time. And just, you know, having me go and wait on him was my entry. Not getting any kind of profound teachings, just it made me feel safe, and then devotion and a sense of what you know, refuge means. And then, you know, at that point, you can start listening to the teachings. And you know, he just had this great skill of teaching people what they needed. And I think if you look at the books that are on the table, you see this vast array, this vast range of teachings that he gave to people in different situations. And it's a unique ability to get to the point. And one last thing I will say is when I was working on this last book of translations, so of course some things would just cut to the quick, and sometimes I'd give my wife a page to read, and she would go around repeating that for the next few days. And he talked about teaching others, and knowing your abilities and your limits, and also knowing other people's limits and their receptivity. And he talked about one monk who had this great ambition to be a teacher, and he was a lay disciple, then became a monk, and he was immediately teaching. And somehow it just didn't work out. Nobody seemed to want to learn the way he wanted to teach. Nobody wanted to practice the right way. So Ajahn Chah said when he was sufficiently worn out, then he came to see me. And what should I do? So, you know, instead of saying, well, the Buddha said this, or from my experience, or the scriptures say this, he said, you know, if two oxen are pulling a cart, they have to pull together. If one is much stronger and faster, and he goes charging ahead, then he ends up pulling both the cart and the other ox. So he would be better off slowing down and waiting for the other ox and pulling together. And this is the way he would get to the point. He didn't have to pull out the scriptures, even though he knew them. He could talk about oxen or fruit or chickens or anything. So I will stop at this point and pass the baton to Joseph.